Welcome back to Three Decades of Tragedy, History of the 30 Years' War. So last time I talked about the war between France and Spain in the Netherlands, which was a back-and-forth conflict, France and the Dutch having success on the ground and naval fronts, though by the early 1640s, the Spanish managed to defeat and rout the French forces due to their armies being divided, the French army, that is. Which is part of the lead-up to the Battle of Rocroi. But on the Spanish home front, things weren't going as well as Olivares was finally asked to leave office, his policies having given little success overall, and the King of Spain taking over directly, changing very little of the overall plan, which had proven not to be as successful as a grand strategy. France also had a change of leadership, the Queen stepping up after the death of King Louis XIII and Richelieu's student, Mazarin, filling in the role as her minister and primary policy driver. They proved that they wanted to end the war on better French terms, staying French patriots despite their foreign birth, though they were still open to talks of peace, and they weren't intending to try to have a complete victory, just get out of the war with as good terms as possible. And with that done, we end this trilogy with the Battle of Rocroi. This battle was essential for both new leaders, as the French needed to get a big victory to cement the new stability of the government, or at the very least, needed not to lose as the new leadership took place. And the Spanish wanted to repeat the success by de Milo the previous year, and he advanced with an army to Rocroi, besieging the city on May 15th, 1643. The town offered very little strategic value, though de Milo claimed it was the key to Champagne, which is not very true at all, but like I said about a minute ago, the French could not afford to have a major loss so early on. The French forces were put under the command of Condé, the Duc de Enghien, the elder general being removed as he was seen as a liability, as well as to distribute the patronage a bit more. The siege was seen as a secondary front, so sending a younger, less experienced commander made sense at the time, even if hindsight showed this wasn't going to be some minor battle. However, it would be a good choice, as the Duke would later become known as the Great Condé after a few years later, when his father died. And adding to that, he was an heir to the throne, fourth in line, in fact. De Enghien went with a risky strategy, which went against the advice he was given. He planned to do a direct attack on the Spanish forces instead of trying to lift the siege of Rocroi more subtly and quietly/steadily. This basically forced him through the forest path, which would leave him exposed and open to ambush by the Spanish. This is basically how the massacre of the Black Forest against the Romans went. He got into the path by traitorous German allies and the enemy ambushing them. He was outnumbered as well, having 15,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 12 cannons, to which the Spanish had 18,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 18 guns. It wasn't by a significant amount, but until he could get through the clearing to the southeast of Rocroi, he was exposed. However, the French did arrive at the perfect time, arriving by the evening of May 18th, which meant it was too late for either side to battle. This gave the French army time to rest for the evening, and the fact that they weren't ambushed tells me the Spanish guts were either not good enough or the French were able to avoid them or eliminate them. Both forces rested for the night on the plains outside of the city, and the French were given intel on Spanish positions by a deserter. The big news was the fact that there was a unit of 500 musketeers on the edge of the forest. Taking a bold move, De Enghien sent a unit of 300 French musketeers at 3 a.m. to catch that unit asleep, routing them. An artillery duel then began, and the armies were given enough time to form up as visibility was poor, probably mainly because it was early morning and it was a bit hazy and dark. The French and Spanish arrayed their infantry in the center in two lines, the French adding a third line of their best infantry and cavalry as a reserve. Cavalry was on the flanks of both armies in two lines, the Spanish cavalry in more independent formations, while the French were in tighter formations to mix with musketeers, which they had adopted from the Swedes. It made them slower but more powerful and used combined armed tactics. The Spanish line extended around 2.5 kilometers, going from the eastern edge of the forest to the St. Anne's Marsh. And to relieve the city, the French would have to break through that line. The French are under a time crunch, de Milo waiting for Beck to arrive with reinforcements, so the French led an initial attack at 5 a.m. De Enghien led the right cavalry charge, while the left flank led to another attack, though the left flank charge started too far away, getting chewed up before they could engage the German cavalry. The French cavalry was then routed and fled, the infantry retreating back as they abandoned some of the guns. The right flank had a bit more success, but they were pushed back by countercharge, and the infantry were beaten by the Imperial cavalry. The Spanish counterattack was messy, and their units were spread out, though they did drive the French back. And while this sounds bad, the superior French discipline allowed them to rally their retreating troops on the left and take advantage of the dispersed Spanish cavalry. This allowed the French on the left flank to rejoin the battle and drive the German forces on the Spanish right off the fields, which would clear an entire flank that was protecting their infantry. And De Enghien ordered one of his commanders to take half the cavalry to drive the cavalry on the Spanish left off, succeeding, which left the Spanish infantry exposed to the flanking cavalry. This whole time, the infantry had been engaged with the Spanish infantry, and now free of the cavalry, the French horse pushed against the Walloon regiments in the second line, forcing them to flee the field before the Germans also did the same. The Italian forces in the first line were made of sterner stuff, but even they retreated after the first failed attack, leaving good order. But to the French, this was fine as this only left the Spanish tercios, who were the last remaining infantry. Two were beaten in quick order, but the remaining three pushed back three attacks with volley fire, the fighting having been going for 5 hours, and compliments to them for holding the line for so long, probably surrounded by enemies. But after 5 hours, the tercios had run out of ammo, but the French also feared Beck arriving, and they were exhausted due to 5 hours of the fighting, so they negotiated with the Spanish, willing to accept a surrender. One regiment of 2,000 men surrendered early, asking to be allowed to retreat safely. Some tried to keep fighting, but it was clear the battle had been lost, and all Spanish forces surrendered to the French soon enough. It was a hard-fought victory, but the Milo managed to join Beck on the other side of the forest. It certainly wasn't a battle where the French easily crushed their enemy, as it was an intense amount of fighting, and the Spanish were able to retreat or surrender in good order. But Donghain showed his bold strategies could work, and it was the first of his achievements in his career. French discipline and organization won them the day, their ability to reorganize and recover key to driving back the enemy. If the left flank hadn't recovered, the battle may not have been in the French favor. The French also used combined arm tactics, and this battle is cited by 18th and 19th century generals as a reason why the French linear tactics were superior. And keep in mind, despite all the French surrender monkey jokes, the French had a pretty solid military history for most of the medieval and early modern period. And by winning the battle, the French ensured that their new regime did not suffer a major loss in their intro, which was a major propaganda victory for them. The French seemed remarkably good at playing down their defeats and playing up their victories, which is a good thing for a medieval kingdom who wants to pride themselves on military power. Casualties were around 4,500 French killed and wounded, and the Spanish lost 4,000 captured and 3,500 killed or wounded. And the loss of so many Spanish commanders and veterans did a number on their capabilities in the Netherlands. However, the French would lose around 7,000 more during the upcoming campaign due to disease and starvation and, you know, the normal campaigning stuff. The army was exhausted, but following the battle, the French took Thionville by August 10th and Sierck by September 2nd. However, the Spanish were still a threat. The army of Flanders, around 78,000 strong, which was even bigger than the Dutch forces, who was only around 60,000. However, this was becoming a pattern of the Dutch by this point, the scale of their military being reduced as peace talks became more feasible. Internal Dutch politics were pushing towards compromise and peace, envoys being regarded with more respect, or at least legitimacy, and Frederick Henry was being more limited in his ability to go around the rest of politics by representatives and other people in the Netherlands. And with his power being reduced, serious peace talks could begin, which would lead to the grand negotiation of the war at Westphalia, where the end of the Thirty Years' War could begin. And next time, we discuss the negotiations' early steps, their methods and goals, and the general idea that was going on behind the scenes as the war was still being waged for around 4 or 5 more years. I want to thank you all for listening. Social media links will be in the description box or on links themselves. You can email me at 3decot@gmail.com. Reminder that I have a Patreon. Thanks to those who support me. And please review and spread the word. And I'll see you guys next time.